I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Whether it's shared custody after a divorce or single-parent households, nowadays a family in this country can be a lot different than one in the 1950s. Today, learn what factors influence our choice of a mate. Those include gender, race, and income, and we'll discover how these choices are remaking the American family. After that, a look at another American tradition, sandlot baseball. Find out how the Royals in Kansas City are helping reconnect kids in the urban core with the sport. We'll also take a peek at the local documentary exploring it all. Later, we'll discuss the recent controversy surrounding Missouri State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The definition of the American family these days can include divorced parents sharing custody, single moms and their kids, or same-sex couples raising children. No matter which scenario you pick, one thing's for sure, the average family unit is no longer reserved for a woman married to a man and their 2.3 kids. What's behind changes in who does and doesn't marry, who's paying the highest price, and what role does the law play in destabilizing the family? That's the subject of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. June Carbone is one of its authors. She holds the Robina Chair in Law, Science, and Technology at the University of Minnesota and was formerly on the faculty here at the law school at UMKC. June, welcome to Up to Date. Welcome back to Kansas City. So good to have you here.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Marriage markets. That sounds like something an economist would say, and not at all how most people might view finding Mr. or Mrs. Right. What do marriage markets mean when it comes to this book?
Well, and indeed, The Atlantic had a story last week calling it transactional marriage. But we think it's just as romantic as it always was. The question is, how do you find somebody? And when is the right time to commit? Mm-hmm. So whether you're looking at the people who get married or the people who don't get married, they agree on one thing, and that's that marriage is about a really serious commitment. So the question becomes, what are the preconditions for that commitment? And the top and the bottom are going to in very different directions on that issue.
Meaning what exactly, the top and the bottom? Income?
Well, you know, we struggled with that in the book because it's a mix of income and education. There, you know, if you talk about class in the U.S., there isn't a single measure. And we think education is probably the best proxy. But, you know, your college graduates used to look a lot alike, and increasingly they're not. Let me give you just one interesting little tidbit. Mm-hmm. If you look at college graduates who come from college graduate parents, they overwhelmingly marry each other. If you look at women college graduates from working class families, they're more likely to graduate later, maybe at 24 instead of 22. They're less likely to marry a fellow college graduate. Hmm. And they don't get as big a bump in terms of income as they would if they were coming from a better educated family. But women's income overwhelmingly correlates with degrees, men not so much. So for women, education tells you a lot more than it does for men. You know, Mark Zuckerberg never finished Harvard.
Huh, that's interesting.
And there are a lot of men doing well without degrees, not so much for women.
But what do you make of this distinction between men and women that you just pointed out, that women who have college degrees, how it affects their income may be very different than how it affects a male income?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. So when you look at the women who are doing well, they're in the middle. Nurses, school teachers, social workers. And when I say doing well, none of those folks make a lot of money. Maybe the top nurses, but most of the rest do okay. Secure jobs, regular paychecks, benefits. Mm-hmm. And they require degrees. So even if you think of social workers, people who help other people in need, you need the right kind of degree. The way to increase your income is to get a master's. The credentialing is really important. When you look at men, there are a lot of small businessmen who may not have college degrees, who do better than women with college degrees. And they may be doing construction. They may be the owner of the franchise at McDonald's or the manager at McDonald's, not the line employee, or if they've got their own business on the side doing something.
What do you make of that?
Well, for marriage purposes, mm-hmm. Here's the issue that we think is not there. I mean, and at the end of our book, we were frustrated by the lack of data on this issue. Stability. So when you look at things like breakups, married or unmarried, it's women who call it quits. The man may be cheating on her or doing things that lead to the breakup, or he may even want the breakup. Typically, the woman is the one who calls it quits. And that often happens at a low point in not just their relationship, clearly, but often in how the man feels he's doing. So if what you've got is a lot of instability, you know, think of doing construction. My father did construction, and it was a roller coaster. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, summer, things were going like gangbusters, middle of winter, not so much. Good economy, you might have more work than you can possibly do. Bad economy, you have trouble making money at all. That creates enormous tensions. If the woman has a steady job with an even income and the husband's on a roller coaster, when he's not doing well, they fight. And he behaves badly. If you look at things like the recent Great Recession, women respond to being laid off by doing more around the house. Men respond by doing less around the house.
That's interesting.
They drink more. They watch TV more. They hang out with the guys more. They're more likely to beat up their partners. And so if you see an economy that produces a lot of instability in overtime, instability in employment, instability in income, especially for men, that increases tensions. And women who see that, working class women who see that, often say, I'm going to hedge my bets. We'll live together for a while. We'll see how it works out. When we feel secure, that'll be the time to get married. Why? Because she's going to be the one to kick him out if the relationship ends.
That's interesting. You know, from the research you and your co-author, Naomi Kahn, conducted, you found inequalities on more than one level and then looked at their impact on how or whether we pick a partner. Let's go into some of these a little bit more here. Gender inequality, the ratio of men to women at any given time. What happens when there's a significant greater number of, say, women over men or men over women? What changes there?
Very robust literature on that. So when women outnumber men, women look at the men and say, my prospects aren't so good. A very nice, more recent study on mass incarceration of African Americans. Lock up more of the men. The women respond by investing more in themselves. Now, this affects...
Investing more in themselves how?
In terms of income.
Okay.
It's their career that matters. They don't trust the men as much. Now, it's very important because, you know, Bill Wilson started pointing this out in the 80s, that a lot of the policies that affected African Americans meant there were simply more women than men who were marriageable. Mm-hmm. Some of it is sheer numbers. More black men die than black women by the time they reach adulthood. Some of it is being locked up. But some of it is just men who are unemployed, into substance abuse. There are more men than women who become unmarriageable. Now, when that happens, very important, it's not just the men who are in jail or who are on drugs who don't marry. It's also the good guys. Hmm. The good guys with jobs and stable behavior become less likely to marry. And the question's why? And the reason is that it changes the dynamics of the group. The men who are outnumbered by the women find out they can play the field, that a lot more women will have them without their having to clean up behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And this is particularly true of fidelity, so they're more likely to cheat. As the women see this, and, you know, this is true in all kinds of societies. I mean, there's a very robust data on cross-cultural comparisons. Mm-hmm. If you see the women outnumber the men, okay, the men play the field, the women distrust the men, the women come to rely more on their own income, their relatives, they don't expect as much as the men. The men see the distrust from the women, and that makes them even less likely to commit to the women because the women aren't treating them that well. So you have a cycle, and it reinforces each other. The women see that, and they, you know, come not to rely on the men. The men see the women's distrust, and they say, why not play the field? Neither commit to the other, less marriage.
That's interesting. During the world wars, there was an obvious decline in the number of available men. These days, you say mass incarceration, as you've mentioned, is having a similar effect, especially among men of color. What else are you seeing on that front?
Yeah, but the bigger, absolutely. So the most robust studies on this involve African Americans, because in poor African American communities, you see real disparities in the number of men and women. There are more women. And if you look at well-off college graduates in cities like New York, and you look at African Americans and Latinos, there are more women than men in the upper middle class ranks. And so you don't see the drug abuse, but you do see problems with commitment. But when you look at now what's happening to working class whites, you don't tend to see, the numbers are not so dissimilar in most places. Instead, you're seeing something else. And what you're seeing is this unwillingness, again, of the women to commit. Now, men don't commit for different reasons, but women have become more reluctant to commit where they see a man who doesn't contribute 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that, there's some great studies that say, working class women, well, if I live with a guy and I don't feel like cleaning the house, then the house stays dirty. But if I marry him, I'm making a commitment to have a nice house. I have to clean up.
Right.
So you get that. But you also see the guy who runs up the credit card bills. If he's making more money, and the men still typically make more money when they're working. If he's making more money and running up the credit card bills and spending things on himself, no big deal. If he then, no more overtime, he's getting laid off, and he's still running up the credit card bills, then they're big fights.
Huh. How about education inequality? This plays a role between men and women because nowadays, the boss isn't as likely to marry the secretary, and I'm wondering why not?
I had a friend whose mother wrote the book. She's a sociologist, sadly died of a heart attack at 48, and she wrote the book on gender ratios. And he said to me, we were talking about this, and he said to me, the guy, like a law professor, who would marry a secretary, somebody who is not his equal intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's going to get a lot of flack from his friends.
Mm-hmm.
You're not man enough to manage somebody who's your intellectual equal. It's really looked down upon. So it's a loss of status. Male college graduates, something like 87% marry female college grads.
That's interesting. This is Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. My guest is June Carbone, co-author of Marriage Markets. She speaks tomorrow at the Kansas City, Missouri Central Library as part of Women's Equality Week. The first program begins at 6:30, and RSVP is requested at kclibrary.org. In looking at these inequalities, June, who is most likely to marry these days, and whom are they marrying?
The only group in American society whose marriage rates have increased are the top 10% of women by income.
Huh.
So if you go back to, say, 1960, college graduate women, who then were only about 10% of women, were less likely to marry than women who didn't go to college.
Because?
Because they placed themselves out of the marriage market.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, people were marrying young. The average age of marriage in 1960 was 22 for men, 20 for women, the youngest age in a century.
That's amazing.
Yes. And if most people are getting married at that age.
If you wait to get a degree, then you're asking for,
you're
leaving the market. Yeah,
right.
That's amazing. Those with higher education marrying each other have a higher earning potential, as you pointed out, which means they can invest more in their kids. What's happening at the other end of the scale?
Well, so as I was saying, the problem with the bottom end, there are two big reasons not to marry. The first is this instability. So for women who are poor, Or even working class, but with a guy who, you know, where the income is on a roller coaster. She's going to have to kick him out at the low end. Now, if they're, you know, the point where she will want to kick him out tends to be a low point for him, how he feels about himself, which tends to have a lot to do with how much money he's making. It's not that she kicks him out because he's not making a lot of money. She kicks him out because after he gets laid off, he behaves badly.
Right.
So if she's thinking about this guy and she's saying, I'm not sure what's going to happen. We might make it work. We might not. If she gets married and she wants to kick him out, then she needs to go to court. She bears the burden going to court. It's a pain. It can be expensive. It's time consuming. And no judge is going to grant a divorce without giving the father custodial rights.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't marry, she kicks him out. He leaves. Now, if he wants a formal court order to see the children, he has to go to court. And if you're at the low end and he's had run-ins with the criminal justice system, or if he isn't that good at following through on getting there, filling out the paperwork, paying the fees, whatever, it's less likely to happen. If he does it, he's likely to get custodial rights. Judges want to see fathers with their kids.
Mm-hmm.
But it's less likely to happen that way. The burden's on him. So marrying is a commitment, not just during the relationship, but afterwards. This is a guy who's going to be involved in your children's lives unless he checks out completely.
And so are we seeing marriage rates at that income level dropping?
Dramatically. So it's changed a little bit, but, you know, almost if under the age of 29, more than 50% of births are outside marriage now.
Let's get into a particular area of expertise for you, June, and that's family law. How are existing laws holding back working class and lower income families today?
Well, as I said, one of the things that is really underappreciated is the commitment marriage imposes. So that marriage involves a commitment everybody gets. Poor families say the same thing as wealthy families. Marriage is a commitment. It's for life. You don't go into marriage thinking you're going to divorce. If you're not sure, you don't get married. And I just went through the piece about what happens in terms of custody rights. So for poor people, there's not a whole lot of money to divide up. But whatever's in that bank account, wherever it came from, is going to be divided up. Even if the woman has the kids and thinks that's the money I was going to use for the children, that money gets divided at divorce. You don't marry, it's whosoever name is on the bank account. But the other piece is domestic violence. So when we look at poor relationships, a new study coming out of Michigan, and it's really eye-opening. So this is Flint, Michigan, mostly poorer women. Start tracking them at the age of 18, 19. The researcher has them do weekly diaries. And at the beginning of the study, none of them have children. None of them want to have children anytime soon. By the end of 2 years, about 15% will.
15.
Mm-hmm. And here's the kicker. What predicts whether or not a woman is likely to have a child at the end of the two-year period? Turns out that the characteristics of her partner predict that. And the men who father children are more likely than the men who are partners, same woman, don't father children. They're more likely to be violent, to want the children, to be older, to be involved in what I think of it as a predatory strategy.
Meaning?
Often the act that produces the pregnancy is violent, coercive sex.
Hmm.
Often they sabotage efforts at birth control. Of having the child, getting the woman pregnant is an exercise in control. They're proud of the children, but they're also more likely to be unfaithful than some of the other men. So, and you know, I did a conference on this, and my colleagues who attended asked the researcher, why are the women with these men?
Mm-hmm.
And her answer was there weren't a whole lot of good choices. So their other partners were somewhat better off, but in general, their choice in terms of men don't have stable employment, not great behavior. But the men with some of the worst behavior in terms of violence and unfaithfulness tended to be the ones most likely to want the child and to do things that encourage the women to get pregnant rather than to prevent it.
Just a final point. What do you do with that information? Well, how can that help things?
Well, I mean, one of the things I feel is the great undiscussed factor is birth control. So if you say, why are college-educated women more likely to be married? One reason is they postpone not just the marriage, but the first birth.
Mm-hmm.
Having that first birth derails a lot of things. It derails education. It makes it harder to move someplace else to take a job. It gets in the way of waiting until you meet the right partner. Now, in the old days, you know, women got pregnant. We made everybody get married. And it kind of worked because of a high level of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, men went off to work, but they could get jobs. And they hung out with the boys afterwards. And the woman took care of the kids with her family. Nowadays, that marriage is not going to last. And the shotgun marriage doesn't work. If you prevent the first birth, good things happen. And they usually happen for that woman. She ends up with fewer kids and more investment in herself before she gets pregnant, and often better relationships if she has the option. But she also ends up with fewer kids.
Hmm.
And if the poorest women who don't, you know, particularly want these pregnancies have fewer kids, then the percentage born to poorer women decreases. So they're a little bit complicated, but it's a compositional effect. If you have women who don't want children having a lot of accidental pregnancies and mm-hmm. keeping the children, you have more children being raised within poverty. The United States has the highest unplanned pregnancy rate in the developed world.
Hmm.
And it's a direct result of social policies.
That's interesting. Well, June Carbone is a co-author of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. You can hear more about it tomorrow at the Kansas City, Missouri Central Library as part of Women's Equality Week. The program begins at 6:30. You can RSVP at kclibrary.org. June, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically. We'll talk about Sandlot Baseball and whatever happened to it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we chased the Great American Eclipse to Parkville. You can hear how that turned out at kcur.org and on the NPR1 app. Tomorrow, we meet the University of Missouri System's new president, Moon Choi. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when I was a kid growing up, and there's that phrase, we played a lot of baseball and softball wherever we could find a field to play in. After school and summer afternoons were the time to play, and all we needed were three guys on a side, and off we'd go. We'd play until dinner time, and sometimes after dinner, too. What you hear these days is that kids don't play sandlot baseball as often as they used to, but maybe the influence of the city's new urban youth academy and all those baseball fields will change that. Kansas City Public Television has put together a remembrance of sandlot baseball in Kansas City titled Call the Sandlot that you can find at flatlandkc.org. Here's a clip that will give you a sense of this series.
I loved baseball in the sense that my dad always had the transistor radio and, you know, the smell of the freshly cut grass and just hearing baseball going.
Our sandlot would be basically wherever we headed that day.
Our backyards, you know, because no one had a fence in them days, so you could play.
We had a gravel driveway and I'd be in the driveway with a broom handle hitting pieces of gravel and things like that.
You didn't have to have nine on each team. You know, the kids got together, we said, we're going to meet here at the park and we're going to play.
If you had four on four, then you got a pitcher, you got a couple outfielders, you got an infielder, and it's pitcher's hand.
You know, a lot of times we'd play where right field was out. And you just have to play in left field because you didn't have enough guys to have a full team.
And sometimes the tree actually, sometimes it was a home run depending on the wind and some other things and who was, you know, doing the lawyering on each side when we were 12 and all that.
As I was a kid, my mother pitching to me in the backyard. She pitches to me and I swing and the bat hits me in the stomach. The handle of the bat is so big it hits me in the stomach and knocks the air out of me. I will never forget that because A lot of kids have not experienced anything like that.
We would rip blankets off of our friends in their bed and throw their glove on their chest and say, come on.
I must have been like 13 or something, and I went up with my dad, and at that point in my little life, like, I crushed it. I mean, I barreled it. I hit it a mile. And I remember going back, this is so dumb, but I remember going back like a week later and trying to measure how far I hit it. And I know I lied. I know I said, oh, I hit it 410 feet. It was probably like 150 or something like that. But absolutely. And that feeling, you can't replicate that. You know, you can't fake that.
Well, with me here to talk about Sandlot Baseball in Kansas City are Bob Kendrick, who is president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum here in Kansas City. Bob, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Steve, thanks for having me, man.
Jonathan Bender is the producer of Call of the Sandlot. Jonathan, how are you?
Really great. Thanks, Steve.
Bob, what is Sandlot Baseball? Why is it called Sandlot Baseball? Do we know why it's called Sandlot Baseball?
Yeah, because you really didn't have to have a field. You made your field.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that was the romantic nature of what Sandlot represented. You touched upon it, 3-on-3, whatever the number it was, you just divided them up and played. And as people were recalling their remembrances of Sandlot, if you hit the ball in Mrs. Jones' yard, you were out. And so that's what made it so special. And as the gentleman was talking about barreling it up, and when you're 12 years old, that 150-foot probably that feel like 400 feet. But that's the beauty of Sandlot.
I love that story in that clip we just heard about shutting off right field, as you just heard. We used to do that all the time. And I haven't thought about that, Jonathan, in forever, this idea that, okay, we're not enough guys here today. We'll just right field. You hit it there, you're gone. Where did the idea for this thing come from, Jonathan?
Yeah, part of it was I wanted to get back to that sense of love. You know, where does our love for baseball come from in Kansas City?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, some of what you're talking about sadly has disappeared.
Yeah.
And so how much effort does it take today to kind of recreate the magic of what you experienced as a kid?
You know, older folks like me sit around and ask this question all the time, Bob. Why has Sandlot Baseball disappeared? I mean, it's as American as eating apple pie, and we're still eating apple pie. So what's happened here?
You know, we've seen this generational thing. Our children are a little bit different now. And I think the times have changed, sadly, you know, particularly as we look at it in the urban core where the sandlots are completely barren. And even when you go out and you look at the suburbs, there are not a lot of sandlots anymore. You know, there are these majestic soccer fields. The baseball fields are majestic as well. So everything is now moved and shifted to organized.
Yes.
And I think that has kind of robbed us of that just simple joy that Sandlot brought. But we don't have the neighborhoods also the way that we used to, and the guys would just get together. And I think that's one of the plights that certainly in the urban core has hurt Sandlot baseball. Matter of fact, killed Sandlot baseball. It just doesn't exist anymore. And that's sad. It really
makes me crazy that adults feel like they've got to be engaged in everything when it comes to kids. They've got to organize it and run it and be umpires and all that stuff. Let the kids figure it out themselves.
Yeah, we did. We did.
We did. I think that's what you did.
Yeah. You know, I remember hearing the late, great Buck O'Neill just say, and this was so true, and you alluded to it, you went and you played all day. Your mother had to call you back into the house.
Yes.
Now you got to push them outside because things have changed. They've got these, you know, they got these phones and they've got the computers and these things that the kids seem to occupy themselves with. So the outside and the recreational aspect is not what we would like for it to be. And again, I think just the fact that the neighborhoods have changed so dramatically, and I think the parents feel like they have to micromanage the activities that our children partake in, number one, to make sure that they are safe, number two, to make sure that it is now kind of living my dream through my children. So they're going to play organized, and we're going to spend a bunch of money to do so, and it just took away the joy of what Sandlot Baseball.
You're
going
to spend a bunch of money. That's so true. Jonathan Bender, do you find any other reasons why Sandlot has gone away the way it has?
I think Bob touched on a really important point. Sam Mellinger from the Kansas City Stars, who you heard about, you know, talking and hitting that home run, and he said the idea that our kids would disappear for a day, you know, parents can't handle that concept anymore. And then the costs associated with baseball is a real challenge.
Yeah.
And between league fees, traveling, and the actual cost of equipment.
Yeah.
I think that's really hard for kids today and families to afford to play baseball.
I think that's so true. You're right. When we were younger, you would go find a field, and it might be blocks and blocks from your house, and mom never knew where we were, but she didn't care either. I mean, wasn't worried about it.
Also, there's this impromptu version of baseball that we seem to have lost. You know, we still play catch, but we don't necessarily play baseball. You know, Frank White talked about this idea of every Christmas, his sisters would get dolls, and he'd wait until they stopped playing with them, so that way he could pop the heads off the dolls, wrap them in black electrical tape, and then go play on the blacktop by his school.
That's what you did. The creativity that came along with it was really special. So rarely did we have all the necessary equipment to play. We just made it. You know, so you cut a tree limb and that was your bat. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have bases. It could be a rock that was the base or whatever it was. Or Frank alluded to the broomstick. You know, I got in trouble with a lot of broomsticks and mop handles, you know, during my day and that whole 9 yards. And kids are a lot more savvy now. And that does not appeal to them, unfortunately, because they don't understand those simple joys kind of the way that we did as kids. And I think it's a generational thing. It changes with each generation.
Bob, I just wonder if Major League Baseball, if professional baseball writ large, is concerned about this, because you're not having kids grow up in the sport, and maybe they won't be as skilled and as experienced as a result, and that might dry up the pipeline a little bit or slow it down a little bit.
I think that is why you're seeing an Urban Youth Baseball Academy being built. And we're so proud that it's being built right behind the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't be more excited, Steve, about this beautiful facility that is being constructed, hopefully ribbon cutting later this fall. But as you
I was going to ask you, when's it going to open up?
You drive I-70 and you look down at Truman Road, there's this magnificent facility. It has changed the landscape of 18th and Vine completely.
Yeah.
I think it's scheduled to have ribbon cutting later this fall, a date to be announced, but really excited about that. Number one, it's going to take away the economic barrier that has prevented a lot of urban kids from playing this sport. As Jonathan and you both know, that once it becomes organized, it's a very expensive sport.
Mm.
Very expensive.
Jonathan, you found a great sandlot field, or looked like it, in the making of this little documentary you've done here, with the skyline of Kansas City right behind. Where was that field?
Yeah, that's at Mulkey Park on the west side. So we had a great day shooting there. You're exactly right. I mean, it's right across from the FBI building, so they keep an eye on it. But it's a chance for the neighborhood right at 11th and Summit. You could hit a home run. You know, you could aim for downtown. I don't know if you could actually get it there.
But I tell you what, and it warms my heart. You know, we're building the Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center. And thanks to the foresight of Ollie Gates, he put a little miniature diamond on the south side of the building.
Hmm.
And so to see kids coming out and they're out there playing shadow ball, or they're playing wiffle ball on that little miniature diamond, just, it absolutely warms my heart. It fills my heart with joy to see that kind of, you know, it's not structured. You know, we just happen to ride by. Oh, let's get out and do that. Now, they're playing shadow ball. They don't even know they're playing shadow ball.
What is shadow ball?
Which is basically a pantomime routine. So you just act like you're playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going through all the motions of playing, but you don't have a ball. And the Negro Leagues were so skilled at shadow ball. Guys like the late, great Goose Tatum. And they were so skilled, Steve, that they would actually start off throwing the ball around the horn. But at some point, they would discard the ball, and fans could never tell they had discarded it. And so here we are, you know, years later, and kids are out there going through this pantomime routine. It just harkens back memories of the Indianapolis Clowns and Goose Tatum and guys like that. And so it's a beautiful thing to see.
Is it safe to say that most of the Negro Leagues players started off playing sandlot ball?
I mean, absolutely.
It goes hand in hand,
absolutely. And the same set of circumstances and situations that we were referencing early on. I remember talking to the great Hank Aaron, who grew up, and I heard Frank talk about hitting bottle caps. Hank Aaron, same thing, hitting bottle caps with a broomstick. Now, you know how hard it is to hit a bottle cap with a broomstick?
That wouldn't be easy.
Yeah. And so if you can hit a bottle cap with a broomstick, chances are you can hit a baseball. And Henry Aaron, who grew up, like a lot of kids in the country, Mobile, Alabama, grew up as a cross-handed hitting infielder. And so he was a right-hand hitter with his left hand on top. When he gets to the Clowns, they put the right hand on top and the rest, as we say, is history.
Yeah.
But the same set of circumstances growing up, you didn't have all the necessities to play the game in an organized capacity, but you didn't need it. All you needed was a love and a desire.
And that's what I love about Parade Park, which is the site of where the Urban Youth Academy is going to be. Baseball has been there for 100 years.
Yeah.
And in addition, I mean, the Monarchs took spring training there.
So oh, is that
this,
right?
There's this really rich history of baseball on the site of the Urban Youth Academy that we got to explore during Call of the Sandlot.
I should point out that KCPT and their digital magazine Flatland will have produced an online 4-episode series called Call of the Sandlot. This series explores the local history of baseball and why sandlots have disappeared. More information, visit flatlandkc.org. What, 3 of the 4 episodes are up now, Jonathan?
Yeah, that's right. The 4th episode will actually air tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
And then the whole show will be on KCPT at 7 o'clock on Thursday.
You came across a Kansas City couple, Sam and Anna Beckett. I'm wondering, who are they and what are they trying to do here?
Yeah, this is what I love. You have the Urban Youth Academy, which is this massive citywide effort. And then you have this couple who's in South Kansas City who spent the past 20 summers taking basically a pocket park and transforming it into a sandlot game every Monday night from when school ends to when school starts. And it's whoever shows up and is ready to play. Moms, dads, kids. I mean, it is really recapturing the spirit of the sandlot.
And do kids come? They show up?
Yeah, that's the beauty. It's 3 to 17. I mean, they have kids now because they've been playing for 20 years who show up and are on their high school baseball team but started out as a 3 or 4-year-old. Yeah. And the great thing is you can hit a home run up until you are 12. And then if you hit it over the fence, it's an out.
Oh, you're kidding.
So there are all these kids who are right on the cusp, 10, 11, 12, just strong enough to barrel it up and just hoping to get one over.
Well, why do Sam and Anna Beckett want to do this?
They say it rejuvenates them. I mean, that it's this lovely thing in the neighborhood. And I loved it. In the middle of interviewing them, they talked about it. And I asked that very question. And then he said, baseball is summer. It's the sounds of summer. It's part of our neighborhood and the backdrop.
It's baseball on the radio and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's that lovely idea of reconnecting with something that you've loved since you were a kid. You know, Sam played with his dad, who used to be on the Milgrams teams, which a lot of people will remember. And they have that chance to revisit it every week during the summer.
Just quickly, you also visited with Royals legend Frank White, who's now the Jackson County executive. What was his experience playing sandlot ball?
Yeah, it was amazingly organic. I mean, he played in Parade Park, which at the time was in the shadow of Municipal Stadium right there in his neighborhood. And he talked about that idea of the reason he got started in baseball was it was his neighborhood. And so you play against the other guys in your neighborhood, and that's where you have to prove yourself. And if you got to Parade Park on Friday night and the guys are there playing checkers and they'll stop their game to watch you play, that's how you know you made it.
That's all right. So the full 4 episodes air Thursday night?
Thursday night at 7 p.m. We'll take you through the history of the Sandlot and also talk about the Urban Youth Academy and Sam and Anna Beckett's game.
It's called Call of the Sandlot. I want to thank Jonathan Bender, producer of Call of the Sandlot, Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Good memories, guys. Thank you both very much. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Steve. Appreciate it, man. Yeah.
Top officials from both parties are calling for the resignation of Missouri State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, a University City Democrat, after she posted on Facebook that she hoped for the assassination of President Donald Trump. Chappelle Nadal removed the post a short time later, but not before it was picked up and has been discussed around the world. The senator held a news conference on Sunday in which she apologized to the president and his family, but said she would remain in office. Here to talk about the controversy and whether the state Senate will expel her from the Senate is Jason Rosenbaum, who covers Missouri government and politics for the St. Louis Public Radio, where he joins us by phone. Jason, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Robin Kuhlman's also with us on the phone. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government, International Studies, and Languages at the University of Central Missouri. Robin, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I should say I'm a member of the STARS editorial board, and we've called for the senator to resign. Jason, what's your sense? Why is Senator Chappelle Nadal refusing to resign here?
I can't read her mind, but I was at her press conference on Sunday, and I think that she believes that she still has time, in her words, to serve the people of the 14th Senatorial District. She did apologize, as you mentioned, to the president, her colleagues, and the people of Missouri. But for, I think, some, especially on the Republican side, the apology came too late. They feel that anybody who hopes for the assassination of a president is crossing a pretty thick red line of unacceptability. And now I think the question comes of whether the Senate is actually going to go through and expel her around veto session.
Professor Kuhlman, I'm wondering what you make of this. This is an extraordinary situation in Missouri politics. We haven't seen anything quite like this for a while. What's your take?
It's definitely an extraordinary situation and a very serious one. Senator Chappelle Nadal has not only received calls to resign from members of the opposition party, the Republicans, but also her own party. We had Lacey Clay, Claire McCaskill, and Senate Minority Leader Gina Walsh calling for her resignation as well. Generally speaking, you know, when you have such broad calls from both your own party and the opposing party, generally speaking, these members tend to resign mm-hmm. when there is some sort of controversy such as this.
You know, Jason, she had this news conference on Sunday, as you mentioned. Describe for us what that scene was like, because she had a lot of her own supporters with her at that event.
She did. She has developed a pretty loyal following in the St. Louis area over the last 4 to 8 years. And I don't remember how many people were there, but it had to be over 50. She made a statement that was a little bit over 2 minutes long and then did not take any questions. I think what's making this particularly difficult, especially for Missouri Democrats, and including her Democratic Senate colleagues who may have to vote on whether to expel her or not, is while she has developed this following and has a pretty deep bench of, I think, personal support within St. Louis, she also has made quite a few adversaries within her own party. You know, for example, her and Congressman Lacey Clay have disliked each other for a pretty long time, and she has thrown some barbs at her fellow Democrats from time to time that have made a lot of her colleagues, I think, uncomfortable. So the fact that she's asking essentially for mercy from her colleagues, it brings a question of like whether she would have offered the same sort of reaction if one of her political adversaries on either side of the aisle had done a similar thing. And I don't know the answer to that because she didn't take questions at her press conference.
I should say she once famously F-bombed Governor Jay Nixon, a member of her own party, over Nixon's handling of the Ferguson crisis. Robin, you get a sense that the word controversy and Senator Chappelle Nadal sort of go hand in hand here.
Generally, yes, they do. It is interesting that, you know, over the past, I would have to say since really a few years after her first election into the Senate, that she's gained such a broad following from members in her district. Now, it's kind of interesting, too, because so that's kind of probably more or less why it's feeling her to kind of stay. But again, like Jason said, we can't read her mind. Go ahead.
But ultimately, you don't think she has any choice, that she's going to have to go.
At this point, it looks like all gears are moving forward for the process to expel her from the Senate.
Jason Rosenbaum, St. Louis Public Radio, do we know what the process for expulsion is? And I read the other day that the senators themselves, it had been so long since they'd taken a look at this that they've had to do some research to figure out how the process might unfold.
I think that's an open question right now. I do know from reading the state constitution that it's 2/3, which equals 23 senators voting to expel or not. By the time, let's just say, either the senators themselves call themselves into session or the governor calls them into session to consider expulsion, they'll have 24 members, Republicans will. So if all the Republicans voted to expel Senator Chappelle Nadal, she would be expelled. And I don't think it's a complete impossibility that some of her Democratic colleagues may seriously consider doing it too, especially Senate Democrats with political aspirations who may be attacked for not voting to expel. That includes people like, I'll name names, Senator Scott Sifton of Afton, Senator Jason Holzman of Kansas City, Senator Bill Shoup of St. Louis County, all these people, I think, either are running for re-election or may have higher political ambitions. And I could imagine them being attacked for not voting to expel if it does. Whether or not people want this to be political or not is kind of beside the point. This will become a pretty big political moment for a lot of people.
Robin Kuhlman, again, from the University of Central Missouri. You know, Democrats don't need this. They're set up for a good year next year. It's a midterm election of a Republican president. Typically, the out party does well during those elections. This could prove to be an anchor on the party's prospects, couldn't it?
It could. And as Jason said, yes, in terms of I would not be surprised if the Democrats in the Senate do turn on her because of their political aspirations, even though, yes, midterms tend to benefit the opposing party of the president. And we see that happen and occur in state legislatures as well. It's still, you know, we're still in, you know, and we're still heavily, I would have to say, set in terms of our districts as to where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. Our Democratic district for the state legislators are going to probably more or less remain Democrats, and I don't necessarily see any major gains in terms of the state legislature. Statewide, though, that's a different animal. Mm-hmm. If for example Claire McCaskill wasn't clear in terms of saying that she should step down and resign, that would have been highly problematic for her in the end. So
we'll have to leave our conversation there. We'll keep an eye on this ongoing story involving this senator. Robin Kuhlman, University of Central Missouri. Thanks a lot, Robin. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jason Rosenbaum from St. Louis Public Radio. Appreciate you too, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you.
Follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, University of Missouri System President Moon Choi. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produce our program. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.